right. It is now my pleasure to introduce our opening speaker, Mary Jo from Salt Lake City.
Hello, everybody. My name is Mary Jo, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Mary Jo. We love you, Mary Jo. Lots and lots and lots.
Exhilarating. And I mean it. I think I've been, I'm kind of wearing down a little bit. My sobriety date is September 16th, 1985. And I got sober at 24, so that makes me 52. So, it's a little warm in this room. I'm not quite in menopause yet, but I'm getting prepared. And I want to tell you, that's a long journey away from when I was 24. And it's kind of surreal. I want you to know that you should tell me I look younger than 50, because I don't drink, I don't smoke, and I don't do any more drugs. Guess I asked for it, so I appreciate that. So in 15 minutes or more, we could try to barrel through a few things. And tonight, first of all, I want to thank the committee for asking me to share. And I much prefer being the 15-minute speaker, so looking forward to a follow-up. Because I could go on for a while. And then I forget what I'm going to say. So I did make a couple notes, because I am over 50, I'm frequently forgetting things, mostly within a few minutes at a time. But I do remember my drinking. And so just a little bit of a qualifier. I come from a family, oldest of four kids. Four of us are alcoholics. My dad's an alcoholic, and I got 3 out of 4 grandparents. So if I wonder where I got it, I really don't have much of a question. But I was one of those kids who was fortunate to grow up in a loving family, and my dad was not the kind of alcoholic who really let me see him drunk. He was a kind of a couple Southern comforts after being on the road. He was a traveling salesman, and he just would fall asleep in the chair. Most of what I remember about his alcoholism is when he didn't drink. He's kind of an asshole. Kind of remember a few table tricks, you know, people get pissed off at dinner, and a couple times pulled the tablecloth out from underneath all the food. You know, and I suspect those were times Murray didn't have a drink to take the edge off. And I really think that that is kind of the crux of alcoholism. It's not being able to stop drinking, but it's also not knowing what to do when you aren't drinking. And what I know about kind of what maybe was kind of preemptive of my drinking, rather than just, you know, whatever teenager starts to do, maybe not everyone, but the ones I hung out with, was that, you know, thing that I still experience today, which is restless, irritable, and discontent with something or everything. And most of it's because I wasn't happy with things if they weren't going my way. I mean, that's really kind of the core of what our problem is, which I come up in front of often. And, a couple other things. I remember being 11 years old and used to live on a cul-de-sac, and we had a woods, and we'd go, you know, I was kind of a tomboy, and we played War in the Woods, and we rode bikes on trails. And I remember one time with about 4 of us, and we found a 6-pack of Rolling Rock. And I mean, I was so excited, I could hardly stand it. And it was warm, we didn't care. So I don't remember drinking it, but I do remember getting excited that it was there. When I was about 12, we stole a big bottle of Lancer's Red Rosé wine, my best friend and I, from her mother, who was our Girl Scout leader. And that was my first blackout. And, I didn't know that until long after that. But when you're 12 and you drink wine, I mean, come on, the brain can only handle so much, you're likely to black out. So I don't necessarily think that was a qualifier. When I got to about the seventh grade, right about 13, I quit Girl Scouts and went straight to smoking pot. And it just, you know, what can I say? It definitely was a better deal. And I thoroughly enjoyed it more simply, you know, I was a Girl Scout for, I don't know, 4 or 5 years and smoked pot for a lot longer. It was something that, you know, at 13 and 14 was just kind of around. My parents drank. I don't remember having to ever be sneaky about drinking. And I kind of grew up in a permissive environment where, you know, we were growing pot in the backyard, and the only reason we had to rip it up was because my grandma was coming to town. You know, I don't think my mom really knew what it was. But my parents were pretty, I would say, they were kind of oblivious to some things. And I think they were going through their own problems. And, you know, I was kind of younger than my best friends, and they used to let my best friends take the car. And I would convince one best friend that I could drive after I'd been drinking. And needless to say, I think my first belief in God is when I went up through the lamppost in the front of the house in a green station wagon and came back out the other side, and nothing got damaged. So call that luck, call that God, it's probably just luck. But I was one of those girls that sought out the guy that had the pot and that was gonna buy plenty of alcohol. And that was just always the most exciting thing that could possibly happen to me in my life. I was not really much entertained by a lot else. Being rather short, you know, now that I'm 52, I have 2 daughters. One is 17 and the other one is almost, she's 20. And, you know, I was thinking back, my youngest daughter just graduated high school this month. And I remember drinking on my high school graduation, and I remember taking that drink and being so excited that I was going to graduate, but I don't remember anything else, you know? And that's really a lot of what my drinking was like. I remember getting excited, going to the bar, and I remember starting to drink, and after that, I don't remember too much else. And it was just pretty much a regular way of living. I didn't see a problem with it. I was somebody who just thought I was enjoying the party. And I think I really did. When I did graduate high school, I really did try to go to college. I really don't even remember dropping out, but I know I only lasted the first semester. And because it really got in the way of partying. I thought, especially if you're smoking pot, you don't remember too much. And I probably wasn't smart enough to retain it smoking pot, so I just thought, why waste my time? So went to work, got a job, and smoked pot every day. And drank on the, I'm gonna drink whenever. And by the time I was 21, I had a boyfriend that I've been dating since high school. He was a couple years older than me. I always like somebody older, not because I got a daddy issue. Just so you know, I just liked him older. I always wanted to be older. And he ended up moving to Houston. And I grew up in Cincinnati, Ohio, which not that exciting. We got a guy here from Cincinnati. He can tell you, not that exciting. And at least it wasn't for me. So I went on this adventure across the country. And I do remember kind of that ego of mine pulling out of my driveway when I left, you know, pretty much saying F you, Cincinnati, and there's my mother crying in the driveway, you know, and that was just kind of, you know, my self-centeredness, wanting to go do and live my life, no matter how, you know, how it affected you. And so moved to Houston, and you know, I was 21 from a smaller suburban town in Cincinnati, and Houston, Texas was a whole different deal. It was the 80s, and the bars did a lot of disco then, and my most famous moment was I think shortly after, well, I moved there, got too drunk that, you know, so much so that the boyfriend left my clothes on the front porch in a couple garbage bags, and that was kind of the end of that relationship. So I just proceeded to find other people to hang out with, you know what I mean? So what happened then was, is I took about three more years of doing disco. And I have to tell you, one of my head outfits to go disco. And back then it was the Farrah Fawcett hairdo, and today I have my hair up because it's sweaty and the lights are on and I don't care. I remember going to Mervyn's and picking out a couple really sweet pantsuits. They're back in style, I want you to know, but I won't put one on. And we used to have heels this high, and and you made sure that your pantsuit was, had enough cleavage that when drinks were 2-for-1 or ladies' night, you could have everything you wanted to drink. And I have to tell you, being this rather naive, budding alcoholic, it was pretty exciting. I thought I had found where I fit. And what I know today is that it was my self-esteem that was looking for validation. And I found it in some pretty shallow places, and places that I laugh about with my girlfriends, but I would hate it if my daughters ended up in those places, So, and what it was like for me on the inside was I hated myself. It didn't matter if he loved me, I didn't like me. And so when you don't like yourself much, you just keep drinking and you just keep using. And there have been, years also that have been, quite drug infested. And, I was, mixing uppers and downers. And I didn't like the uppers too much, but they helped when you were doing a lot of downers. And so I used to have a boyfriend that, he'd bring a bag of Quaaludes home and we would, stir the shake into drinks and, toss it down with some, with some tequila. And if I forget things, well, there's kind of evidence why that might be. And I really truly feel lucky to be alive, because I can tell you there are some nights that I laid in my bed thinking, holy crap, what if this time, the combination wasn't a good idea, And I only ever thought that when I was on that threshold of fear that I might die, because I never really wanted to kill myself. I didn't like myself, but I didn't want to kill myself. I threatened to kill myself if you would stay with me, and I was kind of sick. But I hit a bottom pretty quick, and I ended up being one of those people that sought out again. The guy I was in love with, who was probably pretty done with me, but I was trying to convince him to come back. And one of the things he was really interested in was cocaine. So I found a hookup for cocaine, and so I played ping pong for a while. And so I want to tell you, it wasn't my favorite drug. But smoking crack was one of those things that you don't leave your house, and when you don't show up for work, things can start to get, you start to hit the bottom. And so I did. And at that time, I had been struggling with an eating disorder. So I probably weighed all of about 90 pounds, and still thought I looked pretty good. And I certainly don't weigh that now. And I was able to somehow manage enough to keep it together. I never got arrested, dealt a lot of drugs, and probably got away with more things than I would if I was using today. And I had a call from, I had started to see a therapist who had got somebody to prescribe me Xanax, and that helped for a while. I remember just really using those very carefully, because she told me they were for anxiety. But I had anxiety all the time. But when you're doing uppers, downers, drinking, and throwing up, starving yourself, there's a little anxiety going on. So I thought it was drug related. So long story short, that's the fast train to treatment. So I was one of those fortunate people who had insurance that I could go to treatment. And I went to treatment for an eating disorder. Had no clue about having a drug problem or alcohol problem. So when I got there, I was in Texas, but I went to Florida, and Brochure looked like a spa, and I thought I needed to get away, so I went. Long story short, I got introduced to Alcoholics Anonymous. And in this treatment center, they had me going to AA, CA, NA, ACOA, Women for Sobriety. Didn't like that. They were all old. And I had that restless, irritable discontent. You know, they took away all the drugs, they took away all the alcohol, they started to make me eat food. And I felt like I was coming out of my skin. And I wound up in this Alcoholics Anonymous meeting, and it was in the treatment center, and it was about, I don't know, 8 or 9 guys. Thank God for people who do service to go to hospital and institutions, because they showed up and they came to that meeting and they were reading the book in that small circle. In the other room was the speaker meeting. And I was so restless, I couldn't sit still and listen to the speaker. I don't know how I could sit still in this circle, but I went in there, and all I remember is feeling a sense of I was going to be okay. And I really didn't have, I think, an understanding of that I was an alcoholic. I knew I was a drug addict by the time they got done with me at treatment, because they, you know, in treatment that time, they confront you pretty good. So everything about your character pretty much gets, you know, confronted, and then you have to give some lip service so you can get out of treatment. And I certainly didn't want to stay any longer than 8 weeks. And so I did good, and I got out, and I went to meeting as soon as I got out, and of course, tried to hook up with the guy that I had been dating, and for the last 3 years he was using. And about a month out of treatment, he died. And I say that because this disease is real, and we die from it. And the only thing that was different about his death is I wasn't the one who brought him the cocaine, because I sure usually was the person to do that. It was the way that I got him to, you know, come spend some time with me when I was desperate for attention. And his death, I want to say I feel, I don't know what I felt then, but what I feel today is gratitude that he helped me get to treatment, even if he just wanted to get rid of me. His death saved my life, and I took this seriously from day one, because I was 24 years old. I didn't really know how to do anything but go to the bar. I tried. I went to the bar, and I drank about 7 or 8 Bloody Marys that were virgins, and that's not so good. I went to the bar to try to get laid. I didn't have fun doing that either. And it started to get really uncomfortable without drinking, and the only solution was in these rooms. And in these rooms, there weren't a lot of young people. And I went to a lot of meetings. I was working for real estate. I was doing accounting for a real estate leasing company. And I went to a Monday, Wednesday, Friday meeting at work every day with a lot of folks who were my age now. And they were really terrific to me. And went to other meetings in between. I went to a few dances, but I still never felt very, very good. And I ended up, nice guy walked into a meeting. He was sober, said he was going to Hawaii. And I, you know, of course, I said, well, I'll meet you at your hotel room. And, you know, 6 months later, I moved to Utah. I knew him about 1 month and 2 weekends. 1 weekend, 1 month, 1 weekend. And when I moved to Utah, of course, you know, he met me with flowers and a cowboy hat, and I thought, you know, this is going to be good. And it doesn't take much to entertain me. He thought I was cute as could be. That's lovely. And so I married him. And you know, I thought that would help me out with my, probably my sexual addiction. And it did for a short period of time. It did. And it turns out that what I did is I was passionate about recovery, and I went to school to be a drug and alcohol counselor. And the more insight I got, not so much about alcoholics and addicts, but about myself, it started to look like this wasn't the right person to get married to. And so I'm telling you that because I think if you, you know, have a relationship in the first 5 years, just pay attention, wait a while, pay attention, wait a while, because I don't know if that was my best idea. The best part of it was as I got here to Utah, because it's become my home. And he and I got divorced in 1989, and I stayed sober. And I stayed sober because I stayed close to the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. I had a few friends that were close, and one of my close friends, before I got divorced, we started seeing each other, and I'm grateful to say he's still my husband today. The solution for me to not make the permanent mistake of screwing up that relationship was that I got myself a good therapist, because I thought he was going to just, you know, think I'm the greatest thing ever. And I want to tell you that, and I'll wrap it up pretty quickly, that he was a guy who was involved in Nicky Paul. And it was kind of odd, because I really didn't want to be young. I never wanted to be young. I always wanted to be older. I always, you know, the boyfriend that died, he was 9 years older than me. I always wanted to just feel like I could, you know, just not have to do my youth anymore. And so when I came to Icky Paw, it was kind of odd. And I call myself an Icky Paw widow, because he and my best friend would go be on the advisory panels, and I'd get left behind. But it forced me to get out in the crowd and be a part of Icky Paw. And I really got introduced to conferences through the young people in AA. And for me, that was part of, I think, one of the best parts of my recovery was really experiencing a large community and excitement together. I do remember one time being alone in Cleveland, and they had a mosh pit or something. They were dancing, and I am just a little older than wanting to do mosh pits. And at that time, you know, some things started to, you know, shift, and I hadn't really been as involved in Icky Paw. I started to be involved in the International Women's Conference of Alcoholics Anonymous with my best friend Kathy, who spoke the other night. And I've been of service. And so, as you know, as I want to wrap this up, the restless irritable and discontent at 28 years sober exists a lot. Some days more than I care for it to do. I think when my kids were little, I felt like I was getting sober all over again. I didn't know how to, I was a full-time mom, a full-time working parent, trying to have a relationship, raising the kids that I had always wanted. I had always wanted to be a mom, yet inside I still felt, you know, like clenched fists. And you know, as Steve said, last night, that, you know, I sought a professional to try to figure out how I could learn how to cope a little bit better, not lose it with my kids, without going back to using. And it was something that was really helpful to me. I'm one of these people who's really afraid to take medication. Went through two natural childbirths. Wouldn't recommend that the first time. But it was that important to me that I didn't pick up drugs and alcohol, and it's that important to me today. I do it because I have the best life that I could possibly have. I'm able to, I feel good about who I am today, and I make mistakes all day long. My kids think I'm a pretty good mom, even though I make mistakes. And for those mistakes that I've made, I've sent them to their own therapist. And now, you know, she's almost over 18 next month, and I'm good. I'm getting closer and closer to being an empty nester, but not before they probably make my husband and I broke. Trying to send them to college, because, you know, one of the things is even though I didn't go to college, it's important for me to support them, so they do. And the other thing that was really important to me is raise them in a sober home. You know, my kids, fortunately today, are not using drugs, and, well, not that they tell me about anyway, but there's not a lot of evidence that they're in trouble with drugs or alcohol, and that's important to me. I don't know if they'll stay that way. I sure hope that they've been given enough here in these rooms. Their family is Alcoholics Anonymous. My kids used to go to school and they said, "What religion are you?" And they're like, "AA." So, because they really don't know anything else, you know, they don't. My daughter, at her graduation party, she had two friends and all of our AA friends, you know. AA is my kids' family. I'm a recovering treatment counselor. And I say that because I worked in the field a long time, and I'm not rich, just so y'all know. We don't all get rich being treatment counselors. But I do want to say that my career in working with, getting to work with others has been a phenomenal experience. But it wouldn't have kept me sober. What kept me sober was working with others in Alcoholics Anonymous, was being of service, was volunteering, was saying yes when somebody asked you to chair a meeting or when somebody asked you to speak. And I do it because it's been the greatest gift I've ever had. And when somebody else, like those people who walked up here tonight, one of them with tears in his eyes, big old guy, you know, that to me is the sweetest thing we could possibly ever find on this earth, you know. And I have that, and I get that every day through the people I get to connect who say, "I just want to feel better." And if you stay in Alcoholics Anonymous, you're of service, and you continue to do it, you'll be able to feel better. You know, and somebody asked me one time at 20 years sober, they said, "Well, really, how is that?" I'm like, "You just gotta dig a little deeper." Because life is messy, life is complicated, shit happens. We get sick, people die, we have birthdays, we celebrate. People graduate with master's degrees. I've seen all kinds of loss and success in my sobriety. I haven't wanted to drink over either of those. And the last thing I'd say is that I have to keep my ego in check because I am a pretty self-centered person. I have a generous heart. I'm very loving. But there is that part of me that my ego just runs riot. And the only solution for that, because I don't drink today, is that spiritual experience. And I've found a lot of ways to help me find that. And I'm still searching. And that's the best part about my sobriety, is continuing to follow a path that really is a spiritual one for this human existence. Thanks.